Let's have a meeting.
Let's have one.
Yeah. My name is Janine, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Janine.
Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. In introducing our speaker tonight, I would like to tell you that he's a really an amazing member of AA and that he worked tirelessly to carry the message to other alcoholics, but I know he doesn't like people saying that sort of thing, so I'm going to simply introduce him as Greg from Charlotte.
Hey, my name's Greg. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Greg.
See, I want to thank both Tim and Janine, I think, for, I guess, kind of asking me or allowing me to be here tonight. I want to thank Janine. She took me to Stone Mountain this afternoon to the park, which is really a nice park. I will say we ended up, like, after a certain point, her feet were hurting. I had to go get the car and come back to where we had left off and get her. And because she was wearing, they were kind of like, I wouldn't say they were heels, but they were like, kind of like low heels. And she was like, I thought we were doing straight walking. And I'm thinking, where I live, Stone Mountain, that doesn't really sound like, you know, it sounds like there's going to be a little, you know, up and down and some stones and stuff. So, but I've known her for, you know, I don't know, 8 years or something like that. So she was a member of my home group, which, my home group is the third tradition group. I live in Charlotte, and we meet Monday night. Right now we're actually meeting, my group I'm a member of, we meet Monday from 7:30 to 8:30, so we're, I guess, a little over halfway through the meeting. It's a big book study, except for the last Monday of the month we do a tradition, so we're April. This month we'll do the fourth tradition on the last Monday of the month. And I can tell you tonight we're finishing the chapter, We Agnostics. The last couple pages, I think. And, you know, I like the reading, how each speaker, you know, basically, you know, forms his relationship with God out of the book. And there were different times where, you know, I was, you know, maybe studied or looked into different religions at different times. And some, you know, so I would have told you I maybe was into this or that at a different time. And there were certain times that I told you, would have told you I don't believe in God. But whatever I told you at the time, I was still living the same way. I was still trying to run the show. And, you know, I'm grateful for what alcoholics has given me, a higher power. And, you know, I can choose that higher power of my own. I have a part-time job now where I recently picked up. I have some friends who own a tree service. And so I'm allowed to do plant health care just for a few hours a week. I can do it when I want so that I can work it into my schedule. And so I can go into, you know, what I do is I can, like, you know, fertilize the soil, I can water, I can do things like that. But the bottom line is God is what makes that plant or that tree grow. I can't just reach in the ground and pull out a tree. And so that kind of stuff is really what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. That it's, you know, I think it's not so much what I believe, but having conscious contact with God or a higher power of my understanding. And I do want to say that my sobriety day, don't get that out of the way, is May 23rd, 2005. And also, I imply that I have a second job. I want to be very clear that I'm not a workaholic. I have a friend who describes himself as a social worker, and I think that's what I am. Like, I'm an alcoholic. And I know in the big book it talks about how, you know, some of us have to curb our appetite to work 16 hours a day. I am not one of those guys. I can work for an hour, and, you know, ooh, I don't like the way this makes me feel, and I can quit anytime I want. So I am definitely not a workaholic. I don't have a problem working too much. When it's time to leave, I have no problem stopping. So, and I will say this too. I think, you know, I've gotten confused on many levels, but certainly with, you know, what's the punishment and what's the blessing? You know, I always kind of looked at alcohol, or what's the reward? I always looked at alcohol as the reward. And it turns out that was a pretty punishing thing. And I kind of looked at AA as a punishment, like you get sentenced to AA. And it's one of the greatest rewards I've gotten in my life. I mean, it's certainly a gift, you know, I probably don't deserve to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So that's, you know, one of the best, greatest blessings in my life. Without that, everything else is, you know, possible. So anyways, I grew up in Charlotte. And I come from a home of, you know, good moral values, a family that does work hard. They didn't pass that on to me, or I didn't pick it up. But they had good work ethics, and, you know, I was taught right from wrong. I will say there is alcoholism in my family, and my mother is a self-proclaimed alcoholic. She, if she makes it to June, but, you know, she'll be 88 years old. And if she makes it to June, the same month, she'll also celebrate later in that month 34 years of sobriety. So I saw her. She didn't start drinking until later in life, and she got sober at 54. And, we have, you know, a great relationship today. We had a terrible relationship for a long time, and that was mainly due to me. people would say, oh, you know, now they would say, you know, oh, I just love your mother. And I'm like, oh man, you don't know. You don't know what I know. And I'm grateful that the wall has kind of come down and I can see a lot of the things that, you know, why they say that. And so anyways, I grew up in a good home for the most part. And I just had trouble connecting with people as a kid. I had trouble, you know, making friends. Didn't have many of them, but... Didn't feel a part of school. I didn't even feel a part of my own family, for that matter. I have two brothers and a sister, and they're all significantly older than I am. When I was born, they were 17, 16, and 14. So I kind of grew up like an only child, which is not, you know, the reason that I thought it was all about me. It's not an excuse for my selfishness and self-centeredness. But, you know, I just thought I was in a world where everything revolved around me. And so... I had, you know, I just kind of always had this, I guess, deep-rooted belief that I wasn't as good as other people. I didn't measure up. So the only way that I could be okay was if I could be better than you and something else. My self-esteem was so low that I had to be better than you or better than others just to be okay. And that could maybe be in a sport, that could maybe be in school. And so that's, you know, I did well in school. My peak was elementary school. I did well. I made A's and B's. I was pretty good in my neighborhood anyways as far as sports goes. I certainly had a lot of dreams. I daydreamed all the time about, you know, how I was going to be a professional athlete and you're going to be the best at this and that. And, you know, I think now that was really just another form of self-will run riot, because what I was doing was, the, you know, trying to play God. If I was God, this is how it was going to be. And it's funny, you know, I wanted the results, but I didn't ever want to put in the work. You know, I wanted a paycheck, but I didn't really want to go to work. I did well in school, and my drinking career began, and I love how it's called a drinking career in our book, because it is what I ended up doing full time. But my drinking career began when I had just gone to what we call junior high school at the time, and it's the seventh grade. I was a 12, turned 13 that school year, and I was now at a much bigger school. I was a small kid for my size, and I was full of fear. Now, that sometimes that fear looked like anger. Sometimes that fear looked like being shy. Sometimes that fear looked like arrogance. I heard one time somebody say that, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, that's what your fear looks like. It looks like arrogance. And the thing is that arrogance has no place in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was full of fear, but I didn't, you know, I knew that kind of looked weak, so I, you know, kind of manifested as, you know, kind of changed costumes. It looked different at different times. And my first drink, I've kind of told you that I haven't always had the greatest work ethic. I'd finished one school other than, I guess, junior high school, and that was a Charlotte bartending school. It was 40 hours. 1 week, Monday through Friday, I think, something like 9 to 5. So I could, self-will could get me through that 1 week. I could, You know, and I loved when I went to that school. You know, I was old enough to drink. I think that was mandatory. And I loved learning how to make the drinks that I'd ordered at bars and things like that. However, you know, obviously my first drink was well before I went to the Charlotte bartending school. So I just made it myself. I took a mason jar and went through my parents' liquor cabinet and just took a little bit of everything that was in there. It's kind of like a schoolyard cocktail, I've heard it called. I put a little bit of rum. And yeah, but yes, I didn't want anything to be noticeably missing. A little bit of vodka, a little bit of bourbon, gin, just, you know, everything that was in there. I don't recall if I put in orange juice or Coke or anything like that, but it was predominantly liquor. There definitely wasn't any kind of like fancy straw or umbrella. I was just real intrigued by, you know, what this was going to do. I had a friend who did basically the same thing, and I had no like belief that it was going to be tasty. I knew it was going to taste bad, and I was in the back of a science class, and I had that little mason jar, and I took as big a swig as I could, and it about came back up, but I held it down. And what happened, I don't know how many seconds after that, for me, was what some of you may identify with, was like the magic of alcohol. I mean, just everything changed. All of a sudden, I wasn't full of fear anymore. I didn't feel apart from, I felt a part of. There were kids that I thought, you know, I was scared to death of, and now they were glad to have me around. And I didn't only like what alcohol did for me, but I liked what it did for all of you, too. Because they just, you know, all of a sudden, I loved you. I mean, you know, it just changed everything. And I think that's a big part of what makes me an alcoholic, is what alcohol did for me. And so that began, you know, what was, you know, kind of a slow descent down. I couldn't see it at the time. My grades suffered greatly, but slowly. You know, that year I made my first C. The next year I made my first D. And the year after that I made my first F. And, you know, that's kind of how it went. The last year I was in high school, I had 5 Fs and a C. So I didn't have a stellar grade point average. I think it was 0.25. Somebody pointed that out. They did the math for me. Like, wow, that's not a very solid grade point average. So, what also happened was I even though I'd been taught good values and things, I started listening to rock and roll music. And this isn't to say this was, you know, to blame anything on rock and roll music, but I got into music, and it seemed like the people that I was, you know, enjoyed listening to, that became my role models, I guess, or heroes or idols, were like these rock stars that, like, they would drink, you know, like, to great excess, and they would, you know, do a lot of things to great excess. And so all of a sudden, you know, there's a part in the book that talks about how, you know, in Bill's story, that how, like, men of genius conceive their best projects when drunk. And that, you know, I thought that's what alcohol, I thought it made me more creative. I thought it made me, like, I thought it did positive things for me. I did not like, you know, then the group of guys I was hanging out with or friends, they weren't all guys, but didn't like call alcohol booze. That would kind of made it negative, like calling it spirits, because it was spiritual. It was, and really, getting drunk was my first spiritual experience, best I can tell. And this one band came through town, a band called the Grateful Dead. I don't know if anyone's heard of them or not, but I was excited to go to this concert, and I got there early, and there were a lot of VWs lined up in the parking lot, a lot of vans, these old kind of vans, and a lot of other cars too. And people had coolers set out in the parking lot, and people were selling T-shirts. They were bright and colorful tie-dyes, and people were selling beers. They were selling a lot of things. And if you couldn't afford to buy a beer for $2 or $1, whatever it was, you know, somebody would give you something. It had been free, and that was just like, man, I found my people. This is it. And, you know, after I drank, you know, all of a sudden those tie-dyes were even brighter. And the music sounded even better. I had, like, the best experience at this concert. And it was so good that soon after that, wow, if it was this good in Charlotte, we really should go see what it's like in Hampton, Virginia. And so I went to Hampton, Virginia. And then after that, wow, that was really awesome. We should go to Maryland. And then after Maryland, well, we've got to go to like Hershey, Pennsylvania. So I ended up following this band around, and I started hanging out with I like to say a lot of distinguished gentlemen, and they had some of the nicknames were Fast Eddie and Tweaky Gary and Gnarly Charlie. And I would ride around in their VW vans, and like they would give me these stickers, and I could sit there and sell them. And I think I had to pay 30 cents for them, and I sold them for a dollar. You know, sell 100 of them, there's like $70 or $200, and I can buy a ticket, I can buy a beer, I can buy whatever I want, you know. And, I go to the show and then pass out in the van, and I wouldn't even know, I'd just come to in the next town. You know, I'd sleep all night in the van. I never did any driving, and I don't think they trusted me to drive. And I would be in this VW van, and bam, we're in Philadelphia the next day, and just like do it all over again. So that's the way I was living. I'd arrived like in this VW van. And I ended up in California. That was kind of like where I did go to my first. I've been to college a few times, but like I said, I'm a great starter, terrible finisher. And so after one stint in college where I just kept going to those shows and kept drinking, ended up in California, and I was living in San Francisco. And I was homeless. I didn't really consider it homeless. I thought I was free. Freedom to me was doing what I wanted, when I wanted. And as long as I could drink, as long as I could go to these shows, as long as, I was eating in the soup kitchen sometimes. I was sleeping in Golden Gate Park. I was sometimes sleeping in a hotel room. I was sometimes, somebody might let me sleep on a couch, maybe in a VW van. So I had no visible means of support. I had no, responsibility or place to live. So, by definition, I was homeless. But I didn't, I was young, 19, 20, something like that. Didn't really consider it a problem. As long as I could drink and do what I wanted, I was fine. And that's the way I lived for about 4 or 5 years. It really went on farther than that. But after about 4 or 5 years of that, I can't remember exactly, somewhere in between there, what became my problem wasn't really like alcohol, or it wasn't a lack of power. My problem was clearly like I needed some funds. I need some money, because what I need is a place to live, and I need an apartment, and I need a car, and I need some things like that, because this, this is the way I'm living is getting rough. So I quit selling stickers, and I started selling things that Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't really, put too much input on, but the state of California had a big opinion, and they weren't legal. They were drugs. And I will say this, because not only did I sell drugs at times, I certainly experimented with drugs. I did drugs, and when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was like, man, I saw my mother get sober. I thought I had this vision of like an alcoholic might be somebody under a bridge with a paper bag, but I thought sober people in AA were kind of well-to-do. I don't know if I'm qualified to be a member of AA. And I would see somebody, like the first speaker meeting, I went to support my mother. I was home for like, it was a holiday party. I went with my dad. And, I'd been to a treatment center by then, but I just did not consider myself an alcoholic. And people were handing me numbers and stuff like that. And I'm like, whoa, you got the wrong guy. But, I see these people speaking, and they might have a coat and tie. And I was like, I could never. That's not me at all. And one of my favorite lines in the book is that, that God does not make too hard of terms for those who seek them. And that really, the people that I got surrounded with in Alcoholics Anonymous were very, very big on being inclusive and never being exclusive. And they're like, look, we don't care about what you've done, but let's talk about what happens when you drink. And that's when I was able to identify that I'm an alcoholic. And once I start drinking, I cannot stop drinking. I didn't use the words phenomenon of craving or allergy. I wasn't hip to all that. But I knew that once I started, something I could not stop. But what I had no idea until I identified with other people's stories in Alcoholics Anonymous was this obsession of the mind. I had no clue about that. I thought my numbers changed. I thought, man, if I could quit after 6 or $20 or these numbers change, then I'm good. And what it is, my mind, I just can't fix the mind that I have with the mind that I have. And I cannot, not take that first drink. always. You know, I've got all these great ideas of why it's not a good reason to drink, but I've got this insane idea that's floating around, and left to my own devices, that insane idea wins out every single time. And so that's really what makes me an alcoholic. And I was grateful that people, that they were like big on, you know, like I said, being inclusive. However, you know, like I'm not really, you know, feeling that at the time. I'm still like thinking that I need some money. And what happened by that business, that self-employed illegal business that I got involved in, money started to come my way. And I was able to buy part of a bar in a town called Santa Cruz, California. And I want to say it was a bar that had live music, like tried to have it, I think, six nights a week, most weeks. And I was booking shows, and I was, you know, this was my peak. This was like his, and, but alcohol was becoming more and more important. It was really, you know, that when people would say like alcohol became my master, I thought that was a little extreme at one point. You know, that's kind of like, I wouldn't have said that, but the truth of the matter is it told me when to get up. It told me when to go to bed. It told me where to spend my money. I pretty much, it told me what to do and when to do it. And that's what happened. So as quickly as that little business shot up, my role in particular went down. I just couldn't keep it together. I had some legal consequences, which I narrowly dodged. And, you know, I'll say this too, you know, speaking is probably not my main gig. What I really do, right now, my main thing that I do in Alcoholics Anonymous is what I love to do is in corrections. I if there's somebody that, you know, writes and needs some literature, this is in the state of North Carolina, I try and coordinate to get that person some literature. An alcoholic, just like me. If somebody is getting out of prison and they're relocating to a town in North Carolina, I try and coordinate with somebody who's in that town who can write them letters, so when they get out, they can have a smooth transition to be introduced into the AA community. If somebody's in a jail or a prison and they have no access to outside participation or no meetings, we try the best we can to get an AA meeting, you know, started in that correctional facility. So, you know, I always say yes when I'm asked to speak, but I think my main gig right now is trying to, you know, just help the self-suffering alcoholic inside the walls. But I try and say yes to everything in Alcoholics Anonymous. But so, anyways, back to so I think I was everything was falling apart in Santa Cruz, California. So I did what is like a geographic solution or a geographic cure. I went all the way down to Southern California, and I'm going to start a new life. This is it. You know, everything's going to be like a fresh start. I'm not going to drink at all, and I think I didn't drink for like a day. Because that's about, I can maybe go about 3 days left in my own devices, but I end up getting arrested and down there, and it wasn't really like, it wasn't looking good for me to stay out of jail, right? So, but I got offered, I got this lawyer, and I got offered this situation where, here's what you can do. You can go to, and I don't think this is an official AA saying, but you can go to 90 AA meetings in 90 days and then stay out of trouble for a year and a half, and you can not, you can avoid, you know, this charge will be dismissed. There are two charges, actually, involving drunk driving and then stuff in the trunk of the car. And that just didn't sound like a good idea to me. 90 meetings in 90 days sounds like really, really extreme. I mean, every day for 90 days. I said, I don't think I can do it. And now, I mean, like, God, I've done that, you know, many times. That's not a problem at all. You know, if you would have told me that 10 years ago, 11 years ago, that, you know, going to an AA meeting is one of my favorite things to do in this world, I would have thought you're absolutely crazy. It's turned out to be one of them. But, you know, if I go out of town, I always try and, you know, I love it. Love going to meetings. But they came back, so I refused that. And, you know, it's funny. Our book talks about, like, you know, I can, you know, live a spiritual life, or I can basically die an alcoholic death. And it's like this really, really tough choice. And why is that? I mean, and the only reason I can think of it is because, you know, I've got the contempt prior to investigation, and I have no idea what you guys mean by living a spiritual life. It looks like no fun, so if it's going to be no fun, I might as well just keep on drinking. But I came back, and they gave me another offer where I could go to my, it was my first treatment center. I ended up going to three, but this one was an outpatient treatment center for 10 weeks, where 5 weeks I only had to go twice a week for 2.5 hours, and the second 5 weeks only once a week for 2.5 hours. So the 2.5 hours, the length of it didn't bother me, but it wasn't every day. That, like, every day thing really got to me. So I said yes to that, same conditions, you got to stay out of trouble for a year and a half. So I went to this treatment center, and that's where they kind of had gotten over on me, where this treatment center made me go to AA meetings. So I was like, whoa. And I had to get a sheet signed. I went to the same noon meeting. It was Monday through Friday. Every day I had to go to 15, so I did it for 3 weeks. And I got the sheet signed, and my ears were shut, and my mouth was running because I thought I knew everything. I thought I had answers. And so I don't know if they read how it works or the traditions. I wasn't listening to anything. And so I did complete that treatment center, but staying out of trouble for a year and a half was starting to look bad. I didn't see the light, but I felt the heat. So I needed to get out of California. So that's when I moved back to North Carolina. And I moved into, I moved in with my parents, which is like, you know, a pretty common move. I moved into a retirement home with my parents, where I was the only person under the age of 62, where there was both parents living and me. You know, and my mother at that time, like I already told you, she is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she was sober more or less 20 years when I moved back to North Carolina. And I can tell you that even though she hadn't had a drink in 20 years, as soon as I got back there, she was suffering as greatly from alcoholism as she probably ever had. Because that's what I do, and I think that's what alcoholism does. It doesn't allow me to put myself in anyone else's shoes. It doesn't allow me to have compassion for anyone else. It just says, feed me, feed me. And I didn't really want to hurt them, but I'm a thief of the highest order, and that's what I do, is I hurt the people that love me the most. And what I did is I stole her serenity. I stole my parents' serenity. And she had gone to Al-Anon because of me, like in the 80s. And I think I'm the only other alcoholic that I'm aware of anyways in the family. So she was going to Al-Anon. But when I was going to California for about 15 years, she ended up quitting because she kept going to AA, but kind of Al-Anon tapered off. As soon as I was back, bam, she's right back in Al-Anon. And that's when I was still living there, and they let me, we were going out of town for the weekend, and they're like, look, we're going to trust you to stay at this house for the weekend. And what you need to do is, I had a list of things to do. I had to feed the dog. I had to water the plants. I had to, you know, keep the place clean, bring in the mail, bring in the paper. I mean, pretty basic stuff. And, you know, the main thing is just don't, you know, this place needs to be as in nice or better shape when we come back as when we leave. And so that's when they left Friday night, that's when I busted into what was my dad's liquor cabinet, and I started doing the same thing that I was 12 or 13. I was, you know, didn't want to get caught, so I'm drinking a little bit of Jim Beam, a little bit of Jack Daniels, a little bit of, you know, just swigging this and that. And here's the thing, what I had always loved about alcohol was reliable. I knew what I was getting, and alcohol quit being reliable for me. So I was like, my father was a surgeon, and I'm like, maybe he's got something in his medicine cabinet where I can kind of, like, you know, crank this up a notch. Went in his medicine cabinet, didn't see anything. Best of my knowledge, my dad's never had any kind of problems, drug or alcohol related. But I went in my mom's medicine cabinet, and I did see a bottle, and on that bottle had a red sticker going down the side of the bottle. And it said what I thought was, you know, all I needed to know: do not mix with alcohol. So I'm like, that's it. That's what I'm looking for. And so I took basically, I don't remember, but I took the better part of a 1 month supply. I want to say 28 pills, but that might not be exactly right. But the better part of a 1 month supply, and chased it with, like, you know, Jim Beam or Jack Daniels or something like that. Didn't have a positive reaction. I mean, like, my reaction that night was I ended up just passing out on the couch. My reaction the next morning was a little less pleasant, and I was like, I've learned to use a computer. I'm kind of behind the times, technically speaking. I've caught up a little bit, but I just learned how to use a computer. This is somewhere around 2001 or two. And so I'm like, man, I need to know what I took. So I did a, you know, search, internet search, typed in exactly what was on that bottle. And what it was it was an estrogen supplement for women who've gone through menopause. So that was my best stuff right there. And I was a self-proclaimed expert in pharmaceuticals too. When they came back, you know, they were like, they have oriental rugs and there were burns and the place was not better than they found it. And so they did what was, I guess, to them the most loving thing they can do or what they had to do. And they had to tell me to leave. So I ended up over in Charlotte and the other part of town living in an abandoned house. And in that abandoned house, I was stealing out of grocery stores for food, eating in a church ministry that was feeding the homeless six nights a week, and every single dollar, dime, nickel, whatever I could come together was going straight towards drinking. And what happened was, here again, money is going to solve my problems. I bought this, I'll say, 280-acre property in Northern California that I was going to do this agricultural project on. I don't know if you guys know what I mean. Never really got that together. It was almost getting ready to get foreclosed on because I hadn't been able to make payments in really a long time, but it sold. And then once it sold, all of a sudden I've got like some money. And that's it. I can buy a car. I can get, you know, all the things. You know, I always thought that the solution or almost a spiritual experience for me was something like that was from the outside in. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, people were like, actually, you've got it backwards. A spiritual experience is actually inside out, and everything that's meaningful, everything that's worthwhile is going to begin on the inside. I'm thinking car, apartment, but before do that, I'm going out with the big, you know, this is going to be the end all be all drunk. This is the last party, this is the one. So I checked into this finest hotel I could get. It was a place called the Budget Inn in Charlotte, and they had a daily rate of $45 and a weekly rate of $135. And I'm only staying for two nights because after the weekend it's a whole new life, starting fresh. And so I just get that hotel room for two nights, and I start, you know, partying. When I say partying, killing myself. And after two nights, you know what? It's getting kind of late. But you know what, let's just do this one more day. So I go down, I pay the daily rate one more day. Next day comes around. All right, this is it. This is the last day. One more day. After the next day comes around, all right, I swear, this is it. After tomorrow, I'm quitting this. One more day. Next day, okay, I swear, I'm not living like this anymore, starting tomorrow. And what I did, kept doing that over and over again for about 3.5 months. It just kept going one more day. And it didn't look like or feel like I was powerless over alcohol. I just thought I kept changing my mind. Just one more day. Just one more day. And so I went through that money that I had. And now I'm spiritually dead. And I'm physically alive with no place to go. And I'm a dead man walking. Terrible place to be. And I certainly don't have time to go through everything. I've been to a couple treatment centers in addition to that other one in there and had some other consequences. So I'd been familiar. I knew where some AA meetings were in Charlotte at this time. And my sobriety day, which I think I already said, May 23rd, 2005, I walked into an AA meeting. And, you know, my bottom wasn't being homeless. My bottom wasn't spending all that money. My bottom wasn't, you know, the worst or biggest drunk. My bottom was when I became willing to get involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't think we get sober on information. I don't think we get sober on knowledge. I think we get sober when we surrender. And there was a guy greeting people at the door at that meeting that I went to, and he was like, "Man, you look rough. It looked like you lost a lot of weight, Greg." And I'd lost about 60 pounds compared to now. And I said I'd been doing some running and some exercise. And I don't think he bought it, but he gave me his phone number. And what started to happen at that meeting, what I think is the gift or the magic or the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I quit. I was, like I said, I was always, I was either smarter than you, or I wasn't smart enough, or I'd done too much of this, or I was different for some reason. And those differences slowly started to melt away. And I became willing to, like, you know, wow, if this works for some of you, maybe it'll work for me too if I give this thing a shot. And I called up this guy and asked him to be my sponsor. He said, "You pray about it." And I'm going to pray about it, and call me tomorrow. I'm like, oh, man, this isn't good. If this guy has contact with a higher power, that is, the higher power is going to be like, "You need to stay away from Greg. He's bad news." And but that's, of course, not what happened. And he agreed to sponsor me. And certainly he got me involved in doing a lot of things. One, first and foremost, he got me involved in, you know, taking the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's like, "Look, we're not going to take the first 3 steps. We're not going to take the first 5 steps. We're not going to take the first 9 steps. We're going to take all 12 steps. And then we're going to find out why." I think, you know, for me, faith is believing in advance what's only going to make sense in reverse. And I won't know that until after I've taken the 12 steps. And then continue to do it, really. And he got me involved in a, you know, a home group and doing service at that home group. First position I had, he voluntold me, I guess that's the word we use sometimes, to, it was coffee. And I'm like, oh man, this guy's getting over on me. Now I'm going to be washing his car and raking his leaves. And when I showed up to do it, he was right there with me. And just like everything else in Alcoholics Anonymous, we did it together. And so he led by example. He didn't just, you know, wasn't just like, you know, barking orders or something like that. And that was really attractive to me. And what he said was right from the get-go, he's, "Look, I just want you to know that I'm another alcoholic, and I'm trying to stay sober one day at a time. I'm no better than you. I'm no worse than you either. But we can do together what neither one of us has been able to do by ourselves." And so I got involved in, you know, that home group. I got involved in some service work. And then he fell and he broke his leg, my sponsor. And his sister died the same day. So he was a construction worker, fell, and he's my age. He's like 19 days older than I am. He fell and he broke his leg. And that was, it was the day I picked up a one-month ship. I don't know if you guys do one-month ships here or not. And I called him up. I was like, "Man," left a message on his voicemail, "Can you believe that it's taken me all these years to get this one-month chip?" And from the hospital, he made it a point to call me back. He's like, "Look, it didn't take you all these years to get that one-month chip. It took you one day at a time." And that cheesy slogan just kind of popped. I'm like, "Wow, you know what? You're right. I'm just, you know, trying to follow a direction for a change." And he ended up going, you know, he had to go to Tennessee where he's from to take care of his family and things like that as soon as his leg, you know, was good enough to go. And that's what encouraged me to, like, you know, you can call your grand sponsor, you can call other people. And what I started to do was going to these restaurants before and after a lot of the meetings I was going to and eat with people and things like that. And that stuff really meant a lot to me. You know, I'd go out with this one guy, and this guy was like a big book guy, and all he would do was talk about the big book. But he really wasn't just like quoting it or saying what he said, but he was sharing an experience based on how it related to that book. And I think a big part of how I got sober was not just in meetings, but, you know, getting to know people and doing things before and after meetings. I was one that, you know, I was a victim. I thought I was a victim. I was never take responsibility. I blamed my family for a lot of things. And I think, you know, a lot of our 4 steps pretty much family, 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 family. And I remember being in a meeting where I actually said this. I was given permission to share, or it was an open meeting, and I shared that, you know, all my resentments are justifiable. And this guy grabbed this newspaper and he popped me in the head. And he's like, "You need to look at who's doing the justifying." And I'm like, whoa, now I'm really mad at this guy too. So, but that's, I think, one of the greatest lines of hope in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that my problems are of my own making. And, you know, what I've got to do is learn how to look at things from an entirely different angle. actually be able to try and put myself in someone else's shoes and realize that, you know, maybe some of these people are sick too, like I am. And maybe, you know, if I knew the whole story, maybe I was just as capable as doing some of the things they did. And a lot of things I thought they did, they didn't even do at all. So I made amends. I'm not going to... I'll talk about one that I commonly talk about, making amends. I made amends to my mother, first of all, and told her that, you know, I pulled her aside. She's a member of AA, so she kind of knew it was coming. I had this little payment plan, and I got choked up. She got choked up. She basically said, you know, I said, look, you know, and above all, I just want to be a better son. And she said, you know what, you already are. Just be there when we need you. And, you know, what, a couple years later, maybe not even quite that long, a year and a half later, something like that, my dad got really sick. And sometimes when I talk about my dad dying, I've gotten really choked up before. I think of a couple times where I'm like, my lip was quivering, and I don't like it. I prefer not to do it. I don't think it's going to happen right now. But this one time I took a guy, a sponsor, and I was coming back from the meeting. I'm like, Patrick, man, I really got choked up. And he was like, yeah, man, I think it's all that estrogen you took. But so... my dad got really sick, and they couldn't figure out. He's having trouble with his kidneys, and after some months, I was able to be there and then be of service to my family, which, like, I had no contact with anyone in my family for 2 years, period. I had very limited contact for, you know, about 4 or 5 years surrounding that. You know, I was able to, like, you know, be there and, you know, be of service, which is not in my nature. That is not in my DNA, trying to what I can do for you. But it's what I've been taught in Alcoholics Anonymous. And they figured out it was cancer, and he died. And we had about, I don't know how many people, everyone from the family pretty much came in town because they knew it was the last day or one of his last days alive, or turned out to be his last day anyways. So they were, we were there like kind of all day talking, and our father, or however the relationship was, he was not talking or his eyes weren't open, but he was conscious. And after a long day, everyone was, you know, like, wow, we should go get something to eat, but one person should stay here and be with Dad. And I was like, well, that's going to be me. And I'd made amends to him, but I remember, you know, when they left, I remember grabbing his hand and saying, you know, Dad, I think, you know, if it's time for you to go, then it's time for you to go, and I think I'm going to be okay. And he squeezed my hand, right? And he did it for other people later on, so it wasn't just like this moment just for me or whatever. But when they came back, the rest of the family came back. They're like, "Why don't you get something to eat?" And I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous because I really feel I'm at my very best when I'm with all of you. And so he died later that day. And about 2-3 months later, I had an anniversary. My mother usually gives me a card on that anniversary. And this one was particularly long. And the part that I'll share is that in that card, it said, I just want you to know that your dad died in peace, knowing that you were going to be okay. And what a blessing you are in my life. Then over the last few years, my mother's had a couple knee replacements. She's had one unexpected surgery, and I'm the only, I guess, family member she has in town. So I'm the one that's gotten to take her to the doctor. I'm the one, you know, which is stuff I would have used to, like, tried to squirm out of. Like, get her hair done, which to me, I think getting your hair done is not that important, but it's important to her. I don't have much hair to get done, so not a big deal. But I've got to do that stuff. And when she had a birthday party, I think it was not last year, but the year before that, there were 17 people there. 12 of those were adults. And every single one of them at some point pulled me over, every adult, and pulled me aside. And, you know, I just want to thank you for everything that you're doing for our mother, or, you know, however the relationship was. And I don't think they know this. They weren't thanking me. They were thanking Alcoholics Anonymous. Because, you know, left to my own devices, I'm selfish and I'm a taker. And, you know, somebody gave me this analogy, it wasn't that long ago, and it was like, you know, this is the glass half empty or is the glass half full? And I've always, always equated that with just optimism or pessimism. And they're like, no. It depends on who's doing the pouring and who's doing the drinking. See, if I'm living my life like I'm doing the drinking, that means I'm a taker. And if I'm always thinking about what I can get, it's never enough. There always can be more. So the glass is always going to be half empty. But if I'm living my life like I'm doing the pouring, what I can add to the situation, the glass is always at least half full. And it's usually full. And as you can tell right now, sometimes it's even overflowing and might even come out my eyes a little bit, which I don't want to happen. So that's the whole thing, I think, in Alcoholics Anonymous is, you know, it really funnels down to how I treat others. And who would have known that, you know, that praying and trying to help somebody else is a means of letting a higher power into my life. And, you know, I can tell you that I pray today, I meditate, certainly didn't do that. I talked about it for a long time. I would tell you about it on the bar stool. You need to do this, you know, the spiritual, and wouldn't do it at all. I had a guy in prison who asked me one time, he's like, how do I pray and meditate? And I didn't really know what to tell him. So I was like, well, why don't we look at what the big book says? And he started doing it, and he was doing it more than I was. And this guy's in prison, and he's doing better than I am, and my ego can't handle that at all. So I'm like, I need to start doing this stuff, and lo and behold, it works for me too. You know, even though I need to ask God, and I say, you know, we have a lot of prayers, I think I need to really spend a lot of time thanking God. And every morning I thank God for three things when I wake up every morning. First thing is I thank God that I'm breaking me up, that I'm alive. I always thank God that I'm sober. And the third thing is I thank God that I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then, you know, I think my prayer for others and for myself really too is freedom. And, you know, my ideas of freedom have changed. It's not just doing what I wanted, you know, when I want. And I've always been more attracted to, like, directly helping alcoholics, but I got voted in or asked or voluntold or however you want to say it to be the GSR for my home group. And I was like, that's politics and AA. That's not for me. And but I've always been taught to say yes to AA. And by doing that, what's happened is getting involved in, you know, some of that stuff, my circle's gotten bigger in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've got numbers, not just in North Carolina, but in other places. So this little self-centered world's gotten, you know, definitely a little bit bigger. And the highway's gotten broader. And so now, when I'm asked to do something in AA, you know, I'm always trying to say yes. Not always because I want to, but because today I have choices. So thank you, Tim, and thank you, Janine, and thank you all for having me.
Thanks, Greg. Don't worry, you went. I'm going to cry. I don't take estrogen yet. We've asked Isla to come up and get out the chip.
My name is Isla, and I'm an alcoholic. I am so grateful to be here sober today and tonight, and thank you, Greg. It was such a beautiful, beautiful message. And the one thing I know for sure is that I can stay sober, but I cannot do it by myself. I need you every day. And my job here tonight that I gratefully accepted the invitation to pass out the chips. And the first one for me, and I think for all of us, is the white chip. That surrender, if you will let us, we will help you. We won't teach you, but we will walk with you and love you, and we'll all do it together. Anybody for a white chip? Congratulations, Mike. Got a last initial?
Yeah.
Mike M. When I picked up that white chip, the first one was April 3rd, 1975. And it was in this building, in that room. I stayed sober 14 years. I got disconnected from my people, and I drank again. The good news is that was 26 years ago. Anybody else here tonight who wants to join us and stay connected with us on a daily basis and take a white chip? Are anybody coming back after a sabbatical? Does anybody have 30 days and nights without a drink? Does anybody have 3 months, 90 days for a red chip? Does anybody have 6 months for a yellow chip? All right! Chris L. 6 months. Woo-hoo! These were all, for me, these were records. I never thought I could stay sober. Does anybody have 9 months for a green chip? Does anybody have the magical 365 days for a blue chip? Nor multiples? Anybody want to change their mind for a white chip? Congratulations to all of us, particularly Mike and Chris. Congratulations and thank you.
Thank you one and all for joining the Blue Chip Speaker Meeting tonight.
There's a lot of news going right. People needing, but they doing without. While others living high, a big piece of the pie, so many they got it wrong. As for me, when I wanted too much, ain't never enough. Fearing that I'm gonna run out. Keep the good stuff to myself. Hide it from everyone else. Save it for a rainy day. If you wanna have it all the time, gotta give it. Sleep.